The history of the Ivy League dates back to 1869 when Princeton played the first college football game against Rutgers. The Ancient Eight, the new book by John Feinstein, explores Ivy League football today. To play in the NFL, one must maintain the highest academic standards and be a great football player. The rivalries are as intense, as are the strict rules, but there is also a genuine purity in the Ivy League, which is something John explores in the new book, The Ancient Eight, College Football's Ivy League and the Game They Play Today. It is a great pleasure to welcome John Feinstein back to the roundtable. Always a pleasure, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. It's good to talk to you again. Thanks.
What number book is this?
50.
My goodness. I think you've been on for most.
Certainly most of the nonfiction. There's 35 nonfiction, 15 fiction, and I think you've had me on for just about all of the nonfiction.
Yep. Well, it's great to have you back. What brought you to this idea of writing about the Ivy League, which has always sort of nagged me as something I didn't quite understand? So I was very pleased to see that you had addressed this so I could learn more about it.
Well, I grew up on Ivy League football, Joe, and in New York City. I used to ride the subway to the tip of Manhattan and go to Columbia games at what was then Baker Field. And Columbia wasn't very good at all, but I enjoyed the games. It was $4 to get in. You could sit on the 40-yard line. And for me, as a kid, it was a lot of fun. And after I left New York to go to college and then on to the Washington Post, I still followed the Ivy League in both football and basketball. And as you know, I did a book years ago on the Army-Navy football rivalry. And I also did a book called The Last Amateurs on Patriot League basketball. And what I discovered in doing those two books is you didn't have to be rich and famous to have a story to tell. I've always believed that. And those two books reinforced that for me. And I was talking to my editor at Hachette about, I guess, a year and a half ago now, 2 years ago now, about what I wanted to do after my book on David Faraday. And I threw out the idea of doing a book on Ivy League football because I've always been fascinated by it. And I knew, as with a Civil War and as with The Last Amateurs, that I'd be dealing with players, kids, who were smart and who had stories to tell. And he loved the idea. He'd read, Brant Rumble is his name, he had read both those books and he liked them. And he said, yeah, let's do it. And so I did, and it was everything I hoped it could be, Joe. The kids were terrific. I interviewed 82 of them from the eight schools, and every interview was good. Not because I'm such a good interviewer, but because the kids were bright and funny and had stories to tell and were willing to share. And I enjoyed the project greatly. And the reason for the title was one of the reasons for the book, that in today's world where teams, schools switch leagues all the time and players transfer all the time, I wanted to go to a place where that didn't happen, where players went to school for 4 years and stayed at the schools where they first enrolled as freshmen, and where I know that the Ancient Eight was formed in 1954, and in 2054, it'll still be the Ancient Eight. It'll still be the same eight schools. They won't realign. They won't leave. They won't bring anybody new in. And I love that idea, that it's sort of a throwback to when I was a kid.
But the glory days are gone, right? I mean, there was a time where you would have 60, 80,000 people watching those games, and now you're lucky if you get 5,000.
Right, except for Harvard-Yale, which is this coming Saturday, and which will always sell out. But you're right. That was a decision made by the Ivy League presidents back in the 50s. They intentionally undercut, quote-unquote, the quality of football. They didn't want to compete for national championships. I remember walking into Harvard Stadium for practice one morning and noticing there were eight national championship banners, but the last one was in 1919. And no, Joe, I didn't cover that team. But they made a conscious decision that they wanted to make sure they had academic standards. They did not want to have athletic scholarships, although, you know, the kids get money based on their family's income. They get scholarships, but they don't get athletic scholarships. And they said, we're going to play 10 games. Back then it was 9 games, and now it's 10. 10 games a year, 10 weeks in a row, no bye weeks. we will not compete in football in postseason play, which I disagree with. I think they should let the players on the championship team compete in postseason on the, in the FCS level, which is the second level right below, you know, Oregon and Notre Dame and all the power schools. But they made that conscious decision to go in that direction. And they think, and I don't disagree, that it's succeeded. It's done well for the athletes involved.
You write about the 2023 season at these eight universities, these the Ancient Eight, as we mentioned. And so what gets a kid on that team? And obviously it is, I assume it's academics first.
Yes. Yes, because they know Ivy League players do make it to the NFL. There's usually about a dozen or so Ivy League players in the NFL, but that's a tiny minority of those who play football in the Ivy League. And they know that even though they love football, even though they love to compete, even though they work at it, that when they graduate, that's the end of football, that they're going to go on and go to law school or med school or Wall Street or wherever, and their future is going to be away from football, unless, you know, a handful of them go into coaching because they love the game so much they want to stay in it. And that's why several of the head coaches in the Ivy League are graduates of the schools where they're coaching. But there were four when I did the book last year until Buddy Tevens got killed in an automobile accident, graduates who were coaching at their alma maters because they loved coaching and they loved their schools. The Buddy Tevens story is very much a part of this book. He had been coaching in Dartmouth for 17 years and had great success, had turned the program around, was a major player in the move to make tackling and football safer. And the scientists at Dartmouth came up with an actual machine that you could put on the field that would show the players how to tackle properly. And Buddy Tevens was a leader in that area when CTE became such a major factor in football back in the early 2000s. And he was riding his bicycle on vacation in Florida in March of 2023 and got hit by a truck.
Yeah.
And he lived for 6 months, but never recovered from the injuries. And remarkably, Sammy McCorkle, the coach who replaced him, he'd been Buddy's assistant the entire time they were at Dartmouth together, was able to keep the team together and lead them to a tie for the Ivy League title, which is a remarkable story in itself. That Dartmouth, which was picked sixth in the league, ended up tied for first with Yale and Harvard at the end of the season.
So you write about a lot about Tevens as well as the rivalry that he has with Tim Murphy. And
his best friend
and is at Harvard. And so what is it about those two and that sort of exemplifies what it is about the Ancient Eight and how these teams go about playing the games that they do?
Well, their relationship was unique. They met when they were 12 years old in a collision at home plate. Buddy always insisted that the umpire was right, that Tim was out. Tim always insisted that the umpire was wrong, that he was safe. They grew up in the same town. They were at each other's houses for dinner all the time. Buddy hired Tim for his first coaching job at the University of Maine, and Tim later succeeded him there. And then they ended up, Buddy back at his alma mater, Dartmouth, where he'd been an all-Ivy quarterback and played on a hockey team at Dartmouth that went to the Frozen Four. And then Tim was coaching at the University of Cincinnati, having great success there. He turned the program around. He was offered the Harvard job for half the money, and he took it because he thought the idea of coaching at Harvard and dealing with Harvard kids was something he didn't want to turn down. He ended up staying at Harvard for 30 years. He won 200 games, 9 Ivy League titles, was 20-10 against Yale, and believe me, that was important. But he and Buddy remained close friends throughout all those years where they were facing each other once a year on the sidelines. And when Buddy was hit by the truck, he was in Florida. Tim was at the other end of Florida, 5 hours away. He got a call from Buddy's daughter, who happened to be his goddaughter, saying he'd been in this horrible accident. Mm. And he and his wife, Martha, drove 5 hours right away to get to the hospital. By the time they got there, Buddy'd had a leg amputated. He was in horrible shape. Mm. But Tim was able to see him that morning. And he kept going to the hospital right up until Buddy died. And the entire Ivy League wore decals that said BT on the back of their helmets for the entire season. And I was fortunate enough to be at Dartmouth 4 days after Buddy died. And I was in the locker room before the game and heard Sammy McCorkle's pregame talk to the players. And I can honestly tell you, Joe, even as I bring it up now, I get chills again because it was so moving and so emotional.
The Ancient Eight is the name of the new book by John Feinstein. It is out from Hachette. Give us a sense of what is the relationship between the Ancient Eight, these eight teams, and the NCAA, and what story can be told with that comparison?
Well, the rest of the NCAA, of course, now has NILs, allowing the players to be paid. And you can transfer tomorrow and play the day after tomorrow in other NCAA schools. The Ivy League has very few NILs, maybe a half a dozen, and fewer transfers. In fact, Princeton had a quarterback last year who was their first transfer since Jason Garrett in 1988 when he transferred from Columbia to Princeton because his father had been fired at Columbia and hired at Princeton. So transfers are almost non-existent, either in or out. Players stay for 4 years. If you get benched at another school, at an FBS school or another FCS school, often you transfer right away because you're allowed to. Ivy League players don't transfer. Harvard's quarterback last year was benched after 5 games. He was a junior. He played very well. And then Tim Murphy decided that the player behind him, Jaden Craig, gave his team a better chance to win. Now, 99% of the kids in that situation where they'd been starters would transfer right away. But he did, and he's going to graduate from Harvard this May.
How does that, and you write about this, but I mean, how does that impact the play? How does that impact the game that we see?
Well, the game you see, obviously, as I said, the teams are not trying to recruit or spend the kind of money you need to spend to compete for a national championship at the highest level. They're trying to put together the best teams they possibly can to win the Ivy League title. That's the holy grail for Ivy League players and teams. And there's no less intensity. I watched every game last year from the sideline, and you could feel the intensity from the players and the coaches for every play. It was a big, big deal in their lives. They know how good they are. They know how great they're not. The biggest difference I saw, to be honest, was size. When I stood on the sidelines, a lot of the players were my size. I'm 6 feet tall.
Right.
There were exceptions. There's a kid named Jalen Ramsey at Princeton who had a 3.71 GPA, who was 6'7", 315 pounds. He will play in the NFL next year. And he will go on, all his teammates say he'll go on and do things far more important than football because he's a very exceptional young man. He grew up in Minneapolis, about 10 blocks from where George Floyd was killed. And he was a senior in high school when the murder occurred. And he and a friend of his, another high school kid, formed a foundation together to raise money for inner city kids to get the education they needed to go to college. These are two 18-year-old kids, Joe.
Right,
and that's the kind of remarkable young man that you meet on an Ivy League sideline. But it doesn't mean that they care any less about the football that they're playing.
How about the embrace that the teams get from the students on campus? And I mean, you know, compare that to a college game at say Auburn, Clemson, or
right.
USC.
Well, one of the big differences is that you won't see Ivy League players being asked for autographs by fellow students because they're just students.
Right.
There are no athletic dorms. There are very few privileges that come with playing football. I mean, when they go on the road, they travel on Friday, so they miss afternoon classes. But Ivy League football players are Ivy League students, whereas, you know, the NCAA outlawed athletic dorms years ago. So what the coaches do is they put managers in the dorms. so that technically it's not an athletic dorm. But in the Ivy League, there's no thought about athletic dorms or doing anything special other than the fact that they all play football.
As you were spending time with the teams and you were spending time working on the book, I mean, are there things that just cry out to you of, oh God, I wish this was more the norm?
Well, yes, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do the book, Joe, because I knew it was not the norm. And I wanted to write about athletes and coaches who live in a world that's very different than the SEC or the Big Ten or the ACC. You know, I'm an old guy, Joe. I wish that college football was like it was when I was a kid, but it's not. I mean, you know, realignment has changed things tremendously. NIL, transfer portal. Ohio State, and I'm not putting them down, it's just a fact. Ohio State has a payroll for its players this year of $20 million.
Right.
And there are cases in both football and basketball where a player will stay for another year, which is a good thing, I think, because they know they can make more money playing in college than trying to go to the pros. And I miss those days when, you know, when I was a kid, we'd go down on the field for every game and talk to the players and coaches. And they still do that in the Ivy League. When an Ivy League game ends, fans come down on the field and talk to the players. Many of them are families, of course, but it is a completely different world. I accept the fact that it's never going to change back. That you know, people complain, say NIL should go away. Well, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of NIL, a very conservative court, by the way. So they're not going away. Neither is the transfer portal. And it is fairer that if a coach can change jobs and go right to work, why should the player be able to transfer and go right to work at his sport? So I'm not against any of these things, but I miss the old days when it wasn't that way. And I loved being in the Ivy League for an entire season. I interviewed 82 guys, Joe, 82 players, and every one of them was a good interview. And I enjoyed that greatly. And there were some wonderful stories to be told that I told about some of these athletes. And a few of them may play in the NFL. Most of them won't.
I guess I will close by asking a question just about your process of what it takes for you to decide that you're going to spend a season on a particular project, whether it be golf or basketball or, in this case, the Ancient Eight.
Well, it's pretty simple. People ask me that, and my answer is I get an idea in my head, and I say that would be fun, that would be interesting, that would be a good book. And then the question becomes, can I execute it? Can I get the cooperation that I need from the people involved, whatever the case may be? And in the case of the Ancient Eight, I couldn't have gotten more cooperation. I had total access to the games, to being in the locker rooms, to being on the sidelines, to being at pregame meals, whatever it might be. And I enjoyed it greatly. I enjoyed the fact that after they got to know me, because the coaches introduced me to all the players during spring practice, they, you know, accepted me and sort of saw me as part of the furniture during the games. And that's my goal. My goal is to be there. When I wrote A Season on the Brink, Steve Alford, who was the best player on that Indiana team, wrote a book a couple of years later after they won the national championship. Not during my year, unfortunately, but they won the national championship a couple of years later. And Steve wrote a book called, cleverly enough, Playing for Night. And the chapter on his junior year, which was my year in Indiana, was called The Invisible Man. And that was me. And I liked the idea of being invisible or being accepted by the subjects of my books. And during the Ancient Eight, I could not have asked for more.
What is it like this season watching these eight teams play, Knowing what you know from last season and knowing that you're not working on it now?
Yeah, it is different. And, I root for all eight teams. I certainly rooted for them when they played non-conference games. And it's very difficult for me to see the losses, and it's fun for me to see the wins because a lot of players are still there, are still playing, that I wrote about. And it is a different experience, though, not being there every week. It's kind of weird waking up on a Saturday morning and knowing I don't have an Ivy League game to go to. I almost have to adapt to that.
John Feinstein is the author of The Ancient Eight, College Football's Ivy League and the Game They Play Today. The book is published by Hachette. John, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
Joe, thank you for having me again. I've always enjoyed our talks.
Thank you very much. Bye, John. Again, the name of the new book is The Ancient Eight. It's published by Hachette. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.